When it came to Hank, Pearson knew that having Emerson on his team was like having a Cadillac, albeit an extremely tall, gangly, hook-nosed Cadillac, in the garage. Hank Emerson was one of the most unlikely-looking warriors one could ever imagine, but he was a winner, a brave, inspiring leader whom Pearson knew better than to play musical chairs with. By the time the 2nd of the 502nd left Fontiette, the gunfighter had been with the outfit for 8 months. With his own gushing enthusiasm, he'd built a great, spirited unit from the ashes of Gibraltar the previous September. Now, as the brigade moved on to the bamboo labyrinth of Nyan Ko to begin operations, the O2 and its leaders stood poised for their finest hour with the 1st Brigade, when Hank's boldness and combat savvy, coupled with his troops' total professionalism, would turn a potential massacre into the very model of how to fight this war. But there was still one thing to be learned from Fontiette. The Fontiette operation ended not much differently than it had begun. Nothing happened. At least in the first week, one funny encounter had a Tiger or Recondo long-range reconnaissance patrol bursting into a VC training camp in the middle of a class, the subject of which was, "Beware of American long-range patrols." But in the second week, after combing the area side by side with troops of ARVN, the Regional Forces and Popular Forces, RFPF, and other friendly Viet elements, probably 5,000 men in all, with only light and minor contact, the only thing the 1st Brigade discovered was that the intelligence had been wrong. The VC did not have a huge redoubt on the 2 and 3 Corps boundary in that area after all, so the Fire Brigade picked up again, and as XO I was responsible for kicking the brigade out. Our security perimeter got smaller and smaller as one battalion and then another took off in C-130 Hercules aircraft. As the support elements left, the area shrank even more. And just because it couldn't have been done any other way didn't make it any less precarious for the men left on the ground, or any more comforting. Finally, only a few vehicles and some 25 or 30 people, the team involved with the coordinating and executing the move, were left on the ground. ARVN was in the area for security, but since I'd learned early never to depend on them, I was damn anxious to get us all out of there. A lesson learned during our first major operation together, as a matter of fact, when the brigade opened up Route 19 for the 1st Air Cav. At the time, since we were operating in the 22nd ARVN Division's AO, Colonel Timothy had told me to coordinate the brigade's passage through the area with the Viets and to get the 22nd to secure the three bridges between Quinyon City and the base of the critical Anke Pass. Those bridges were essential for the safe movement out of Quinyon of two Screaming Eagle battalions worth of ground attack forces. I was so impressed with the 22nd ARVN CG's no-sweat major, airborne-all-the-way attitude when I conveyed Colonel Timothy's request to him that come the morning of the operation, I was absolutely shocked to find not a single ARVN trooper in sight. We'd had little choice but to send our ground forces on and just pray the bridges hadn't been blown or mined. Luckily, the operation went on without a hitch, but the experience taught me a very valuable, if harsh, lesson. Never to give a Vietnamese unit a role that was critical to any operation, and never to trust a Viet again. On both counts, I never did, over the entire 4 years I spent in Vietnam. Finally, our aircraft arrived. Equipment was stacked on, jeeps driven in and tied down, all of us got on board, and soon the plane turned around and took off. Just as we cleared the airfield, there was a terrible explosion in the back of the plane. We'd taken multiple hits, with at least one slug cutting a fuel line, sending JP-4 aviation gas spewing around the cabin. The crew chief shut off the valves that controlled that line and opened another to direct the fuel around it. We were rerouted to Nha Trang, the nearest airfield that could be foamed, and soon landed safely. But to me, there was a significant message in the incident. For 14 days, at a cost of probably $30 million, 5,000 men beat the bush looking for Charlie, and they didn't find him. And yet, on the very last day, at the end of our very own airstrip, one VC with an automatic weapon brazenly peppered our very last aircraft full of slugs on its way out. "Goodbye, Yanks," each one seemed to say. "See you again real soon." It was as if, whatever we thought, we were really playing the game by their rules. I was at the brigade forward CP merrily shuffling papers when the 1st of the 327th and 2nd of the 502nd began operations at Nhan Co on the 2 and 3 corps boundaries, like Phan Thiet, but well inland along the Cambodian border. Again, the battalions were faced with terrain they'd never experienced before. From the air, the triple-canopied jungle obscured the maze of solid bamboo below, so thick in places that with every man hacking through it, progress was still no greater than 30 meters an hour. Two divisions could simply disappear in a few kilometers of that kind of bush. For the troops, plagued by long black wood leeches whose bites led to infection on top of infection, little to no sunlight for days on end, and the beginning of the monsoons in this region of Vietnam, the first week of operation was a strenuous, exhausting fight with the jungle and nothing else. Hank Emerson got even more ornery than his men as day after day brought no contact for the O2. On a hunch, he'd decided to slip his unit south across the boundary into 3 Corps and take advantage of an airstrip at Bu Gia Mop, an abandoned Special Forces camp. When Emerson's L-19 was fired upon in an early morning reconnaissance of the airstrip, he knew his hunch was going to pay off. A short time later, Hank Lund's Alpha Company made contact and captured a malaria-ridden, panic-stricken soldier from the 141st NVA Regiment. Lund gave the prisoner water and got him covered with a blanket. Then Emerson landed, and before he hit the guy with a long barrage of questions, he gave him some cigarettes and a much-needed meal. The POW's reaction to this kindness was simply to break down. Hank's interpreter explained that the NVA had been told he'd be beaten, tortured, and then shot if captured by the Americans. As this was obviously not the case, the grateful prisoner eagerly provided Emerson with the straight skinny on the disposition of his unit. A 4-company ambush was waiting some 40 minutes away, and 6 more companies were behind them at a further 40-minute walk. From the moment Hank Emerson treated that prisoner right, he could do no wrong. Lund had already discovered a well-used track. Now, little by little, Emerson's scattered units tightened up as Lund moved forward to converge on the enemy position. Emerson maneuvered his people brilliantly. His bold, small-unit checkerboard tactics, which he'd developed at the War College in 1964 specifically for Vietnam, while everyone else was still wallowing in the British experience in Malaya, gave way to an almost conventional configuration in another turn of the evolutionary wheel on how to fight these guys. For what Hank wanted to do, he needed combat power, so conventional was about the only way to go. The final confrontation with the 4-company ambush did not take place until the following day. Emerson told Lund, his senior ground commander, who'd proved to be as fine a combat leader as he was a staff and peacetime man, a rare combination, to plan the ground operation, and it worked like a charm. Lund's men, along with Captain George A. Hamilton's A Troop 17th Cav and Captain Ronnie Brown's composite task force of cavalry, recondo, and Apache Montagnard troops, silently encircled the waiting NVA ambush. Using massive air and artillery support, they proceeded to bushwhack the enemy bushwhackers in good old Yankee fashion. When it was over, of the 450 NVA troops who'd been lying in wait, only 50 remained alive and more or less intact. As for the 6-company ambush the first prisoner had mentioned, Emerson chased these guys to the Cambodian border. There he could only look on helplessly as what was left of the 141st NVA slipped safely across into the neutral ground, where trucks could be seen waiting to ferry our enemy to the safety of his Cambodian sanctuaries. The successful operation at Bu Gia Mop was a newsworthy item, jumped on by the press and higher HQ. Directly after his crowning success, Lund and his people received the dubious honor of clearing an LZ in the shattered jungle for Dan Rather and his television crew. An 8-hour job, but it was that kind of war. Swede Larsen came up to the border to see the battlefield and talk to Hank Emerson about the fight. It was one of the last things he'd do before going back to America to brief the Pentagon press on what was happening in IFFV. During that briefing, besides declaring that the 101st was the best fighting unit in Vietnam, Larsen would relate the fact, well known at the highest levels in Vietnam and proved beyond doubt at the bayonet level at Bu Gia Mop, that the North Vietnamese were operating out of Cambodia. This information would be big news in the USA, which by day's end would be vehemently denied by the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense. The press would then go back to General Larson, whose innocent, honest heels had been hurriedly locked together in the interim, and he would say, "I stand corrected," from the corner he'd been backed into for reasons he didn't know. This incident well characterized one of the biggest problems in the war, which only got worse as the conflict went on. Out there, every day, American men were playing for the ultimate stakes. Yet back home, it seemed as if the politicians and bureaucrats who sent them there were playing by a different set of rules, if not a completely different game. There were NVA in Cambodia, so far 4 to 6 regiments worth, who were already killing American soldiers in South Vietnam. If they remained unstopped, they would kill many, many more. To the guys like myself on the ground, it was as simple as that. So none of us could figure out why things were not that simple. When Walt Meinzen was evacuated the night before the 1st Brigade's next big mission, I had already been in Vietnam for 13 months. On top of that, I was scheduled to rotate home in just 4 weeks, so I was incredibly surprised to find, the morning of the operation, that I was to take Meinzen's place as commander of the 1st of the 327th. "You were down there 7 months, and you know it better than anyone," General Pearson explained when he called me to his command tent at the Central Highlands Special Forces Camp at Dock To. "We're going to have some tough opposition this time, so get right into the plan. Any questions? Come back to me." It took everything in my power to keep from dancing out of the tent. "Daryl, we got a battalion," I sang to my patient RTO driver waiting by our jeep. It was not just my fondest wish come true, but at that time in my career, the highest accolade I could receive. "I'll get our gear together immediately, sir," Daryl replied with a huge grin, knowing full well that after I'd taken him with me from brigade to battalion and back to brigade, I would surely want him by my side now, when I confronted the challenge I'd been waiting and preparing for since I was a rifleman in Italy so many years before. I arrived at the battalion, and it was old home week. All the old-timers rushed up with the chorus of, "Great to have you back." It was as if I'd been away at brigade a year rather than a month. I had a look at the battle plan. The 1st of the 327's mission was to relieve a nearby special forces camp at Tu Morong, atop a high mountain reportedly surrounded by a large NVA force and under the constant harassment of mortar fire. A year before, the June monsoons had set the stage for the enemy to successfully overrun 8 such outposts, including our present base at Dock To near the Laos-Cambodia-South Vietnam border. With the monsoon season of 66 about to start any day, the powers that be felt it better to relieve and abandon Tu Morong rather than take the risk of a replay of the events of the previous year, which had caused incredible panic that South Vietnam would be cut in half by marauding communists. No two commanders see a tactical problem the same way. As I examined Meinzen's attack plan, I knew I'd alter it after the air mobile assault phase, which in just 2 hours would put us in at LZs behind the Tu Morong objective. My reasoning was simply that I didn't think the NVA gave two hoots in hell about destroying the Special Forces camp at Tu Morong. What they wanted was to destroy the relieving force. I was sure we were being enticed into a very conventional, by guerrilla standards, Viet Cong insurgent trap. That of luring the counterinsurgent force into a situation by making it believe that one of its camps was threatened and that a quick victory could be achieved in the process of saving the day. The fact that two NVA ralliers had just given themselves up at Dock To and reported that the SF camp would soon be hit only added to my conviction that Tu Morong was a trap. Meinzen's plan called for 2 rifle companies to attack parallel with the 2 roads that led to the camp, one from the north, one from the east, with the 3rd company remaining at the LZ with our command post and mortar platoon. I felt sure this was exactly what the enemy expected, and they would be waiting along the 2 roads in ambush. So I decided after the air mobile phase, we'd go cross-country instead, despite the hellish navigation and difficult terrain. We'd take our time. Tu Morong had been under siege since the middle of May. It was now 3 June, and another day or so wouldn't hurt them. I had only 1 instruction to give to the battalion before we jumped off. Since the Joe Rogers days ended, the light wolfhound-style bums roll he and I had insisted the above-the-rest troops carry, just the basics, one set of fatigues and dry socks, a poncho, jungle blanket, and sea rations, all tied up with camo wire and thrown over the shoulder, able to be flipped off easily when a firefight developed, had gradually been added to and added to until the men were going into battle like mules again. As Johnny Howard used to say, give a trooper a rucksack, and he'll fill it. But the big loads were disastrous in these highlands of steep mountains, tall trees, and thick undergrowth, catching on everything and sapping vital strength long before contact was even made. So the single order was a simple one. Lighten up. The only question I had about the operation was how I was supposed to go into battle with the call sign like Bald Eagle, especially with Emerson going in as the glamorous gunfighter. I told Pearson I wanted to be Bold Eagle, not Bald, and he quickly had his commo officer change it with a matter-of-fact, yes, Hack, that fits you better. The Tigers had secured our LZ on D1 the day before I joined the battalion, and now our air mobile assault was made unopposed. We made our way overland with the scout section moving Aussie style, well in front of the main force of each company. With our big fists locked together, the enemy realized he wasn't going to get his pound of flesh for free, and in the 2 days it took to get to our objective, we had less than a handful of contacts. We reached the Tumurong camp and prepared for the movement of its 150 inhabitants down the hill to Dak To. The North Vietnamese had broken off their mortar attacks on the outpost, no doubt damn disappointed we hadn't stumbled into their trap. Still, their plans had not been completely foiled. According to Don Corman, who'd heard about it over the artillery net, while we were traveling cross-country the day before, the 1st of the 42nd Arvin Regiment had made their approach to Tumurong along one of the roads, been ambushed, just as we would have been, and taken 4 dead and 19 wounded. Hank Emerson and General Pearson and his staff flew into Tumurong for a what-to-do-next conference. Should we continue to look around here or give up and move elsewhere? Between the Arvin ambush and my gut feeling, I knew that regardless of his present silence, our foe was still in the area. But before I joined the powwow, I wandered over to one of the inhabitants of Tumurong, a Montagnard corporal, who confirmed it. I pulled out a map. Where are the NVA? I asked him. Down there, he replied, indicating a valley below the outpost. Are there many NVA there? Many, many. Maybe a regiment, maybe more. Do you know that for a fact? Oh, yes, the Montagnard said. I patrol there, but I never go there now. None of my men will go there. Thanks a lot, I told him, and joined General Pearson and his staff, the latter of whom were firmly of the opinion that the 24th NVA Regiment, our reported opponent, had vacated the battlefield, and therefore so should we. Of course, Pearson's staff didn't know what the Montagnard corporal had told me, but as I listened to their argument, it quickly became clear that through some very serious breakdown in communication, they also didn't know about the previous day's ambush of the Arvin unit on the road to Tumurong. As such, their arguments for leaving were totally logical, even if they were totally wrong. Meanwhile, I was smelling an incredible firefight that in the unit competition stakes would put the 1327 well in front of Emerson's O2, so when Pearson asked for my opinion, without going into details, I said I thought I might stick around Tumurong for a while and have a look in the valley. It's all yours, the general said. I deployed my units in a recon screen, little fingers to wind carefully down the valley, each platoon no more than an hour's reinforcement time from another. Ben Willis's ABUs, Willis had taken over the ABUs some 6 weeks before when Wayne Dill came down with malaria, since his recovery Dill had commanded C Company, made 3 sharp contacts with an estimated reinforced platoon of NVA. Tragically, during the fight, a friendly artillery barrage landed right in the center of one of Ben's platoons, killing 5 troopers and wounding 5 more. Everything stopped while we sorted out the debacle and evacuated the casualties. It wasn't exactly the greatest way to start the operation. As darkness fell, I had everyone hold up and dig in, planning to continue the hunt come first light. All was quiet until 0200 hours. Then Captain Don Whalen's B Battery, 2nd of the 320th Artie, which was in direct support of us, and under the 1st of the 327th's operational control, came under attack from an estimated battalion-size enemy force. Heavy mortar fire preceded the assault. Then, with bugles blowing, the NVA came at the position in waves, as the Chinese had in Korea, and as the Viet Minh had against France's elite Mobile Group 100, on this very same Central Highlands ground a dozen years before. The gunners quickly found they were virtually on their own. Only one platoon of A Company, 2nd of the 502nd, which was OpCon, the 1st of the 327, under the command of XO Carl Beach, had been tasked with securing Weyland's battery, actually got into position to help them. The O2 Company had been too spread out from the first. As such, some of the company's number got pinned, with the outpost squad closest to the enemy's ingress route nearly being trampled by racing hordes of enemy soldiers intent on only Weyland's position. Meanwhile, with the Smokey the Bear flareship hovering over the battlefield, dropping flares and lighting the ground like day, Weyland's artillerymen fought like lions for their lives and their positions, even reclaiming overrun guns and firing them point-blank into their attackers' ranks. Dawn was fast approaching. I called Sterling Fairchild, whose Tigers were near the action, and ordered him to set up an ambush on the trail I was sure the enemy would use to withdraw before first light. West Pointer Sterling Fairchild, as I will call him, had gone to the Tigers at the same time Johnny Howard did. I did not consider him a warrior in the least, but he was an exceptionally bright staff man who thereafter had played the role of Tiger Administrator S3 while Howard's and Dennis Foley's platoons rotated in the field and fought the war. Dennis Foley had been wounded at Fontiet, and with Jim Gardner dead and Johnny Howard evacuated, Fairchild was now in charge of the unit's maneuver elements. The Tiger CO started to bitch over the very busy battalion command net that he didn't want to do it. He was close to rotation and didn't want to get knocked off. I had more things on my mind than Fairchild's DROS. "Just do it," I snapped. Next, I got Ben Willis's ABUs moving toward Weyland's battery while supporting the defending gunners with 81mm mortar fire, and B and C companies poised for a first light air mobile assault deep behind the enemy's escape route. Between these units and the A2502, I had five strong forces to chop up the NVA withdrawal and pick off their stragglers. I was confident because I felt I'd been down the road before. The situation was not that much different than what the Wolfhound had experienced in April of 51 at the outset of the Chinese spring offensive. Then the Chinese had penetrated G Company and had us all on the run, but by the morning the penetration had been sealed and the Chinese could not withdraw. They were caught in a sack, not unlike what I was trying to draw now, and we had destroyed them in detail. I don't know how or when I got word that Fairchild had disobeyed my order. All I know was that the ambush was not set, no sack was drawn, and come the dawn, many an enemy soldier slipped away down that very trail. Fortunately, the plan was not totally blown, despite what I considered Fairchild's act of cowardice. Between my other elements and our tremendous supporting fire, including Puff the Magic Dragon, an aircraft whose mounted Gatling guns spat 450 rounds per second, enough to cover the area of a football field in 3 seconds, a slug hitting every square foot along the way, a first light sweep of the area revealed 86 enemy dead from the 24th NVA Regiment. Our own casualties for the night were 4 American KIA and 10 wounded. Still, I was furious, and after moving B and C companies out by chopper to sweep down from Weyland's position toward the valley of the Montagnard Corporal's many, many NVA, I brought the Tigers in and relieved Fairchild on the spot. I didn't give a damn if he was a short-timer. Almost everyone was, and some were well past their rotation dates. The Vietnam one-year rotation policy was already panning out as it had in Korea. When people got short, they just wanted to go back to the base camp and hide under a rock. They were dead weight in an outfit, and they didn't do their share, and their lousy attitude was infectious. And in Fairchild's case, while it was bad enough that he, a regular officer and commander of the Tiger Force, bitched out loud on the battalion command net, the fact that he clearly disobeyed an order that might have changed the course of the battle soon to follow was inexcusable. So I relieved him, and I brought in another young captain whom I'll call Neville Bumstead to take his place. I wanted to get the Tigers out into the field again right away, just in case any of them had soaked up their erstwhile commander's cold feet. To me, the most striking irony in Fairchild's behavior was that this officer had not only graduated from West Point, but he'd graduated at the top of his class in leadership. Classmates said, and I had seen for myself before this incident, that the guy couldn't make a decision. The system, or at least the criteria at West Point, had to have been seriously flawed to single out and honor a man seemingly so inappropriate to exemplify this basic and essential quality. In the middle of all this, a reporter came up to me, introduced himself as Ward Just from the Washington Post, and said he wanted to go along on one of our patrols. I gave him to Bumstead and the Tigers and hoped he'd keep his head down. Fortunately, the initiative was all ours, as the above-the-rest companies, each broken into platoon-size formations, giving me 9 maneuver units plus the Tigers, combed the dense highland bush, killing stragglers, 2 here and 4 there. It was the beginning of 6 days of continual contact for the battalion, trying days, but ones in which the men, after a year of growing and learning on the battlefield, remained strong, resolute, and courageous. Besides an enemy who hugged our belts to neutralize our incredible firepower, the men fought lung-busting hills and virtually impassable jungles, terrain as bad, if not worse, than the worst in Korea, more like the Hürtgen Forest along Germany's Siegfried Line. Though I'd long believed the CIDG effort to stop NVA movement across the Laos and Cambodia borders was pretty futile, it took me years to truly appreciate how insane it was for infantrymen to fight in the highlands. Yet my troopers knew, with every step they took, and weren't exactly shy about saying so. At one stage, when my TAC CP and I were tagging along with one of the rifle platoons, the column halted for some reason, and I took a hike up to talk to some of the troopers stretched out along the jungle track. Even though the troops knew I was the man, I wasn't wearing brass, but with an antenna platoon of at least 5 PRC-25 radios with me, it was kind of obvious. They pretended they didn't, and started telling me about the stupidity of it all, how infantry couldn't fight through this terrain, that their weapons couldn't even penetrate the bush, and that the guy in charge, me, must be some dumb son of a bitch. I loved every second of their rave and joined right in. As I scooted back to my TAC CP, I thought those kids were the ones who should be the goddamn generals. Because really, what was the point of fighting in the highlands? If the NVA wanted to cut the country in half, so what? All they'd have had would be a lot of thick jungle, a few mountain yards, and one hell of a lot of malaria. The highlands had no real strategic value. The key to the war was the people. Protect the people, make their lives better, win them, and you'd have won the war. But in early June 1966, such thoughts had not occurred to me, and the Central Highlands Dak To fight continued. On the second full day of combat, 7 June, Bumstead's Tigers wandered right into the middle of an enemy base camp. By mid-afternoon, they were under a tremendous amount of fire, and the new skipper was beginning to crack under the strain. Charlie Company, under the command of Wayne Dill, moved to reinforce and got into a wild fight of its own. Willis, who'd been in a tough fight since his ABUs jumped off the day before, also went to the rescue while we kept the Tigers alive with 155 and 105 artillery fire blasting with pinpoint precision around their position. Meanwhile, word came that the Tigers had taken terrible casualties, among them the reporter, Ward Just. A wounded civilian was a drama I didn't need at this moment, and the only thing worse was the news that Dill's unit, having extricated itself from one fight, had again locked horns with the enemy just 100 meters from the Tigers. As night fell, Willis's ABUs formed a perimeter around the Tigers and the beleaguered members of Charlie Company, giving all within a chance to breathe while continuing to slug it out with the enemy themselves. From the Tigers came word that 8 of the wounded were critical. Without medevac, they wouldn't last until morning. But medevac seemed like an impossible dream. No way could a chopper land at the Tiger position, heavily wooded and ringed as it was by determined, well-entrenched enemy troops, and in the dark yet. Still, an all-volunteer chopper crew dared to try it. They used a USAF HH-44 Husky, rather than a Slick or other medevac aircraft. The bird hovered over the Tigers, and one by one, the brave crew winched the 8 critically wounded on board, as the enemy fired enthusiastically at them from below. All 8 cases made it off the battlefield alive. But later, when Ed Abood, my XO, brought me the casualty list from the brigade collecting station, the flawless operation suddenly displayed a worrisome hitch. The civilian reporter's name was not among those reported to be evacuated from the Tigers. Civilians had priority in this kind of situation, so I was pretty concerned. When I called Bumstead, he explained that Just had refused evacuation because there were men far more seriously wounded who deserved priority. It was an exceptional gesture on the reporter's part, and one that won me for life. Through it, Ward Just joined the Brotherhood and became my friend, and little did I know that my life would never be the same again. When the balance of the Tigers had been sprung and had come home the next morning, they totaled just 16 effectives, 9 of whom were wounded, and a single NCO, Pelham Bryant, who fortunately for the Tigers was one of the best ever to come along. We filled up the unit with new volunteers, but whatever plans I may have had for them or my companies went on hold in the afternoon when Hank Emerson called me and said his C Company was in a big jam and about to be overrun. Battered Willis and the Abus, who had already been in constant, tough contact with the stubborn NVA for more than 2 full days, were in the best position to go to the rescue. I turned them around, and on they went. For better control of the operation, I made Ben Opcon Emerson. But mother hen that I was, I set one of my radios on the 2nd 502nd Battalion frequency to make sure he was okay. What happened next, on 9 June 1966, was one of the great tragedies of the entire 2-week battle. The 1st of the 327th had so far borne the brunt of the fighting at Dock Tow, and we would continue to do so for 10 more hard slugging days. But the newspapers did not report that Ben Willis and the Abus got into the fight of their lives that day, taking 26 wounded and 6 dead on the way to rescue the C-2502, or that one of Ben's platoon leaders, Lieutenant Ken Collins, had his eye blown out during the battle, but continued directing his platoon, holding his eyeball in his hand, or that when the whole thing was over, Ben's men, wounded and all, refused to be lifted out, determined as they were to go out under their own steam. Instead, the headlines blared that West Point football hero Captain William S. Carpenter, Jr., one-time All-American Lonesome End, now commander of the C-2502, dropped napalm on his own troops. The reason for this drastic course of action, so the story went, was that Carpenter was surrounded, had taken heavy, heavy losses, and believed his unit was on the verge of being overrun, with the enemy already swarming among his people. When the incident was over, while it turned out that his unit had suffered some 6 KIA and 25 seriously wounded, enemy dead on C Company's hill were as scarce as hen's teeth. The publicity that ensued was not Carpenter's fault, nor were the John Wayne-esque embellishments of the story each time it was reported. Still, in terms of unit pride and unit rivalry between the 02 and the 327, units that at Bastogne some 26 years before had stood back-to-back, taken the best the enemy could dish out and stopped them cold, the effect of the affair was devastating. And when it was all over, ironically, about the only one among the men of the 1st of the 327 who had a good word to say about the tragic incident was Ben Willis, whose ABUs had taken the brunt of it in the effort to relieve Carpenter's company. "I can't in my heart blame Carpenter for anything he did," he said. "Unless you're there on the ground in that damned jungle under that triple canopy nose to nose with the other guy, you don't know. And if you don't know, you shouldn't pass judgment." Ben was right, of course, but for me as the battalion commander of one damn heroic battalion, it didn't make the heavy Abu casualties or all the Carpenter headlines any easier to swallow. The next day, the refitted Tigers were on their way out again to join Dill's Charlie Company in the attempt to relieve Willis, who was still engaged. Dill found himself in continual contact throughout the day, however, and Willis was left on his own to conduct a nighttime withdrawal from his position. By that time, Pearson had told me a B-52 Arclight strike was on the way. I left Charlie Company, which remained in contact much of the next day, and the Tigers in the area until the very last moment, fixing the NVA in place with dummy radio traffic so the enemy wouldn't realize we were pulling out in preparation for it. The arclight strike dropped silently from 30,000 feet, crackling like a thousand thunderbolts on impact, leaving the ground pockmarked with deep craters like the dark side of the moon. Both 2502 and the 1327 went in right afterward with little resistance. It was estimated the million-dollar strike was responsible for some 200 enemy casualties. Like most of the men in the battalion, I went from the 6th to the 12th of June with no sleep. I was a walking zombie by the time we pulled back for the B-52 strike. As soon as Willis got out and we got him refitted, I hit the sack for 12 straight hours, and I doubt if I ever slept better in my life. Fortunately, the first couple of post-arc light days were quiet, giving everyone a chance to catch up on much-needed rest. Only then did the monsoons come. Luck alone had brought them late, but their absence had been decisive. The NVA's plan had been to lure a major U.S. unit into this area of Vietnam at a time when the terrain and weather favored them. If the NVA had had their way, the monsoonal rains, mists, and low cloud cover would have rendered our air power impotent, and only two forces, theirs and our infantry, would have squared off against each other at Dak Tho. In that scenario, they thought the Americans would have been chewed up, just as we'd been in the past. But while the good weather did foil the NVA plan, I felt sure they would have had a harder time with the 1st Brigade than they'd expected, even if the weather had gone their way. We'd learned quite a bit over the last year, and air power notwithstanding for the main, this time around we had refused to attack the enemy's buzzsaw. The only time we really played into their hand was during the relief of Carpenter. And had that not all happened so quickly, I might have recognized that the O2 company, like Tu Morong, was just the lure, and that it was the relief element, the ABUs, that was really the juicy morsel the NVA were after. It would have been good had Operation Hawthorne, the name given to the relief of the Tu Morong outpost and the subsequent events, ended after the B-52 strike. As it was, the search and destroy missions in the area continued, and on the 17th of June, the weary ABUs, low on NCOs and platoon leaders, high on new replacements and guys just days from rotation, made contact with the small NVA force. There was no point in taking a lot of casualties. Willis played it safe and called for fire support, but the first air cav gunships that came to his aid made a terrible error. Instead of shooting up the enemy, they shot up the ABUs, wounding 21, including Willis and the rest of the officers, most of the NCOs, and worst of all, every single medic, and killing XO George Perry, our not-so-good-at-poker-but-very-good buddy, with a tiny piece of shrapnel through the heart. It was a tragedy only compounded by the fact that Perry, 2 weeks over his DROS, hadn't even had to be there. He'd just wanted to help Ben and his beloved ABUs, and the plan had been for him to take the first resupply chopper out, get his gear, and go home the next day. It was a damn shame. Word of the fiasco quickly got to my TAC CP. I immediately grabbed Daryl and called Raphael at his aid station at Dak Tho. The doc in turn grabbed Milton Turner, the medical platoon leader, and a medic named Nichols, and together with a couple of engineers with chainsaws, they made their way by chopper to the battle area. There was no landing zone near A Company's position, hence the chainsaws to cut one out. Just steep hills and thick forest, no different from most of the highlands. In my CNC, I told the pilot to get as low as he could. We churned through the underbrush, the chopper blades cracking like gunfire against the bamboo and treetops as we cut a hole inching us toward the jungle floor. About 15 feet above what might have been the LZ, Daryl and I jumped out and radioed Raphael that that would be the only way for him and his people, too. The doc was none too enthusiastic about the idea of jumping in, but when he got to the site, the longer his chopper hovered with him sitting inside it, so he told me later, the more he started thinking he'd be a lot safer on the ground than up in the air, because in his mind's eye, he could vividly see an enemy trooper taking aim at him at that very moment. After a very long few seconds, it just became too much for him, and he jumped out of the bird, picked up his aid bags, and headed into the bush. Turner and Nichols were delayed in joining Raphael in patching up Ben and his troops when the engineers jumped out of their chopper and each promptly broke an ankle. But soon things started getting squared away. Luckily, Willis wasn't hurt too bad and could stay with the company. When there was nothing more to be done, Raphael and Turner hopped onto the last medevac chopper out without even a goodbye, leaving young Nichols, Darrell, and me out there without ponchos, without anything to protect us from the torrential rains that followed that night. Having assumed the good doctor would want to suffer right along with me, I was a little aggravated that Raphael hadn't stuck around, but I couldn't really blame him. After all, he'd been there when we needed him, to care for the wounded and set an example for the medics in his charge, and he hadn't even had to do that. No one forced Raphael Benjamin, the battalion surgeon, to tag along on operations or to jump figuratively or literally into the fray, though that was exactly what he did throughout some of the worst of the 1327's fighting at Tuy Hoa and Doc To. The adventure part had died quickly for this civilian doctor, whom I considered among the bravest of the brave, but still, he was always there, because he knew we needed him. And in just the same way, the gutsy 40-man medical platoon Raphael oversaw knew we needed them. Consequently, they flinched at nothing, and as a unit completely turned over 3 times in 1 year. I didn't know what it was about medics. I used to think they joined the medical corps because they had a double load of courage. But maybe it was just the title itself that transformed them into the most valiant band of men I ever knew. Medics didn't wait for a miracle to pull the wounded to a safe shelter. They were the miracle that pulled, slid, dragged, and packed shattered bodies out of danger. And they performed miracles, stopping bleeding, stopping shock, relieving pain with morphine, and getting IVs going to pump life into broken fighters. Many packed M16s along with their 40-pound medical kits, but their job was to save lives, not take them, and they risked their own again and again answering calls that took them right into the line of fire, machine gun, mortar, sniper, mines, without hesitation. Their most powerful medicine was their encouragement. You got it made, just a scratch. You'll see that girl again. A never-ending patter to keep minds occupied while deft hands administered aid or tried to sort out a stomach or a chest ripped open by shot. Grievously wounded soldiers were further assisted by the brave pilots who performed medevac missions, but it was the medics who made the difference on the ground until the choppers could get in. Selfless and serving beyond good sense, countless medics died in the line of duty to save not just their buddies, but the life of every man who fell on the battlefield. From 2 wars, it is these men, the medics, the docs, who hold the most special place of respect and trust in my infantryman's heart. And I'm sure there are a couple of million other men in the United States alone who feel the exact same way. On the 18th of June, a resupply aircraft arrived at Willis's position with the bums roll, complete with poncho, I'd neglected to take along with me in my haste to get to the ABUs the day before. The first thing I did was brush my teeth. In the jungles of the Central Highlands, it was about the only thing you could do to remember you were a civilized human being. You couldn't wash up there. During the monsoons, you were always wet anyway. You couldn't shave. The slightest nick, like the inevitable cuts, rashes, or jungle sores, turned septic. The damp, dark jungle was not particular. Everything rotted there. Your boots, your clothes, your skin. So much for my insistence on a pair of extra dry socks. I learned not to wear them at all at Doc To, or undershorts either. Since you couldn't keep them dry anyway, the only purpose they served was to rub you raw and start the rot. It was a hell of a way to have to fight. We spent the day beating around in the woods, but no contact was made. The enemy force had pretty well vacated the area. After the severe beating we'd given them, we figured they'd slipped back into Cambodia to regroup. With that, word finally came we'd be heading back to the brigade's Doc To base, where it had all begun some 17 days before. General Pearson popped into my forward CP to tell me about the move. "Hack, I've given Emerson the aircraft. They're going to pick him up first, and then come back and get you." I quietly imploded. The 1327 had done the bulk of the fighting. The 2502 ended up getting all the press and all the glory as a result of the Carpenter incident, and now, to top it off, Emerson's people were getting the aircraft and going home before mine. "Never mind, sir," I told the general. "I don't want any choppers. I'll walk my battalion out of here." "What do you mean?" asked Pearson. "We'll just sweep back," I said. I've got over 100 replacements in the last 2 weeks. Almost all the platoon leaders and NCOs are new. It'll give them a good shakeout. And we'll screen the battle area right back to the Dok To airfield. The 10-mile walk took a night and a morning, and it was a good training exercise. Not just for the new men, but for the guys who'd been there all along, if only to shake out their hangover from the big fight. We made no contact, but almost lost a man when a viper crawled into his fart sack and bit him. A night medic saved his life, and the rest of the journey was without incident. Just shy of Dok To proper, I sent a radio message to Battalion S1 Glenn Mallory to bring out the battalion colors and company guidons. I assembled the company commanders and told them we were going to march home walking tall and show the O2 and the rest of the brigade who the real soldiers were in this outfit. Soon my well-proven battalion had lined up at proper intervals in a column on each side of the road, and we began to hike home. I was leading, followed by the colors, my command group, and the Tiger commander, and then the rest of the battalion. Each company led by their individual commanders and company guidons. As we got closer to the base camp, the little entrance Glenn Mallory and I had set up just started to build. It was as if someone had said, "Hey, there's a parade," and everyone wanted to get into the act. All the support people rushed to the side of the road to cheer us on. Even an ad hoc band that started playing Stars and Stripes Forever, and with every cheer my boys stood taller and their stride grew that much jauntier. As we passed the second of the 502nd assembly area, about 20 feet from the road stood Hank Emerson by his CP. He was fresh out of the shower, and he was shaving. He looked toward the road for a moment, his mouth agape, and then he just shook his head. "Hackworth, you son of a bitch," he called with a smile. "Above the rest, sir," I shouted and gave him a snappy salute. It was a rare thrill to outgun the gunfighter. In a totally uncoordinated effort, people were coming from everywhere to look at the warriors. General Pearson had even fallen out with his staff in front of the brigade HQ to salute the battalion as we marched by, and just before I peeled off to join them, a group of aviators did an impromptu 5-airplane flyover of the columns in our honor. I, too, saluted my fine companies as they strutted past, filthy and unshaven, jungle boots rubbed white with wear, still with camouflage in their helmets, some bandaged up and limping like little drummer boys. It was then and forever the proudest moment of my life. We'd taken 27 dead and 129 wounded, but we'd killed 276 NVA for the price. The men had fought bravely and well against terrific odds and in bitching conditions. They'd been in Vietnam for a year, and they'd learned. 16. Box Seat. No lesson seems to be so deeply inculcated by the experience of life as that you should never trust in experts. Lord Salisbury. By the time I finished my first tour of Vietnam, the infantry school at Fort Benning was again in full swing, mass-producing infantry officers to replace the combat and rotation losses of units fighting in the war. I wanted to go there as an instructor when my tour with the 101st ended. To date, the infantry school had not had the benefit of combat people fresh off the battlefield with U.S. units to pass on lessons learned, and I couldn't think of a place my experience or talents would be better used. Instead, newly promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, I was assigned to the Office of Personnel Operations, OPO, at the Pentagon. On paper, this was a very important career assignment. DA duty was a key punch on the old ticket. In reality, it was a 2-year jail sentence in an office deep within the bowels of the Pentagon, with little more to do than sign papers for the 25 civilians I apparently managed, but who kept me and my deputy, Major William Kesterson, blissfully ignorant of what was really going on. No eager soldiers on limited tours were going to disturb their well-oiled bureaucracy. Throughout the 6-week leave I took between Vietnam and the beginning of the Pentagon assignment, no amount of pleading on my part was enough to sway the career managers that it would be much better for me and the Army to send me to Fort Benning. Consequently, I sold my house in Tennessee, bought a new one in Burke, Virginia, and in the course of things got to know Patty and the kids again. As hard as life is for the Army wife, for the children, it is that much harder. Dad's seldom there, and when he is, for any length of time, it generally means the family's about to move again. New house, new school, new friends. Laura and Leslie, not yet 7 and 6 years old, were both on their fourth such move. At 14 months, Joel was too young to understand that part of the Army life, but it was just as well. Having suddenly lost his year-long position as Lord of the Castle, he had enough on his plate trying to figure out who the hell this strange man was who called himself his father and wouldn't let him sleep in Patty's bed. Also, kids, my kids anyway, got away with murder with their mother in charge. Undoubtedly, it was quite a shock to their little systems when I came back with a whole new set of rules and banished anything less than ordered chaos from my home. I don't think it was easy for any of us at first, but the worst part was that just when we were beginning to function really well as a family again, I was on a plane back to Vietnam. By then, I'd been at the Pentagon for 2 stir-crazy months, but just before Thanksgiving, the sun began to shine in my windowless subterranean office when, without warning, Brigadier General S.L.A. Marshall came to visit. I was stunned. Slam Marshall, as he was known, was a legend of sorts in the Army. He'd walked and talked with the greats, Ike, Ridgway, Patton, Bradley, and he was the author of such widely read books as Night Drop and Men Against Fire from his World War II days, and The River and the Gauntlet and Porkchop Hill from Korea. He was a historian come military analyst, considered by some to be the American expert on soldiers in combat. To be sure, he was fascinated by the ultimate game of war. He had already been to Vietnam, where his study of the first of the 101's Highlands fighting provided the stuff for his soon-to-be-published Battles in the Monsoon. I'd met him during that trip, when he was interviewing the participants of our Dock Toe fight, a fight that would win the brigade a presidential unit citation, and in the months since, we'd had occasional contact, always when the general was chasing down some detail to go in his book. But I had not seen him, nor was there any reason why I should have, which made his sudden visit in civilian gear to my Pentagon cranny all the more mysterious. General Marshall came right to the point. "Hack, I've been talking to Johnny Johnson." General Harold K. Johnson, the Army Chief of Staff, the mere mention of whose name brought Kesterson and me to attention. "And we both feel the Army has dropped the ball in Vietnam. We aren't learning from our experience there. The lessons learned are not being recorded and passed on, and we're taking unnecessary casualties because of it. Now, I told Johnny I'd go back and set up a system that will use my post-combat interrogation techniques, but I'd like you to come with me. I'm too old to be trudging around battlefields on my own. Besides, we click well together, and it'll get you out of the Pentagon." In our previous correspondence, I'd made no secret of my hatred for the aptly named five-sided puzzle palace. I was flabbergasted. For weeks and weeks, I'd badgered and harassed OPO's infantry branch for a change of assignment. I'd been told to keep quiet or chance ruining a promising career, and I'd finally taken another step forward in the ticket-punching parade by accepting that guidance in the interests of the bigger things my counselor said I was earmarked for. But then in walks S.L.A. Marshall, a man whose World War II books I'd read and reread since childhood, a man whom I was admittedly in awe of, and offers me not just an out from my horrible job, but the opportunity of a lifetime. It was almost unbelievable. "When do we leave, sir?" I asked. General Marshall told me the Chief of Staff would want to see me before we headed off in just over a week's time. Even so, when I was called to Johnson's office, I felt not unlike a parish priest might feel upon being told to report to the Pope in Rome. I viewed the meeting as a rare opportunity to have the chief's ear, so I prepared a list of points to squeeze into my audience with him, all regarding what I felt was needed to improve our combat efficiency in Vietnam. Much to my disappointment, when I arrived at his office, I was told exactly 5 minutes had been scheduled for our meeting. "Take no more," said the general's aide, Colonel William Caldwell. "The old man has a very busy afternoon. You'll be in and out." I'd met General Johnson once before, about a month earlier, at an award ceremony. Then, as now, when I was called in to see him, I was struck first by the size and splendor of his office, and by the windows, wonderful windows we in the dark depths of the Pentagon could only dream of, that looked out over the swollen Pentagon parking lot and beyond to the Potomac. The chief greeted me in his formal, no-nonsense way. At the age of 54, Harold K. Johnson was the youngest chief of staff since Douglas MacArthur. No mean feat for a man who spent 3 years of World War II in Japanese prisoner of war camps after the fall of Bataan. Tall, straight, and handsome, Johnson looked like a chief of staff. He was a sincere, kind, and genuinely good man who, word had it, was also devoutly religious, with a deep dislike for such soldierly pursuits as hard liquor, fast women, or foul barracks talk. I knew to be on my best behavior. "Sit down, Colonel," he said to me now. "I want to brief you on your mission with General Marshall." It took him about 3 minutes, the gist being that with a view toward improving the collection of basic data on U.S. fought battles in Vietnam for a future official Army history of the war, SLAM would teach the after-action reporting techniques he'd pioneered during World War II to selected U.S. Army officers in all divisions and separate brigades in the theater. Because General Marshall would be visiting Vietnam as a private citizen, Johnson went on to explain, my job throughout the tour, rather than simply assisting him, would be that of representative of DA's Chief of Military History. Privately, I didn't understand the General Marshall is private citizen twist, but I barely had a chance to contemplate it when General Johnson, after a considered pause, said, "Take care with SLAM, Colonel. He is the Army's powerful friend, but he can be a treacherous enemy." I masked my surprise. As far as the conversation I was following went, that comment came straight out of left field. With 2 minutes left out of my five, it was small talk time. The general had met my family at the awards ceremony. Now he asked how they were and how my work was going. "Everything's fine, General," I replied, painfully conscious of the clock running out. "But, sir, if you have a minute, there's something bothering me I'd like to discuss with you." "Let's hear it," he said. "We've had U.S. Army units in Vietnam for 18 months, I blurted out. "Almost one-third of the Army is committed to that war, but at Fort Benning there is only a handful of field-grade officers with Vietnam experience, and half of these were advisors. They weren't with U.S. units. We're just not putting our best and most recently experienced combat officers into the school system, which is where I believe they belong. We're sending them everywhere else to get their tickets punched, as if their careers took priority over the war. Vietnam is the toughest war we've ever fought, and we're going at it as though we're fighting World War II all over again." "Now, just a minute, Colonel Hackworth," the general bristled. "In terms of enemy and terrain, the fighting in Vietnam is no different for infantry than when we fought in the Philippines after Pearl Harbor." "Sir," I said, "that statement is about as far from the truth about the nature of the war in Vietnam as I have ever heard." I couldn't believe the words had come out of my mouth. I could feel my face getting hot as General Johnson, red-faced with anger, stared at me from behind his desk. After a moment, he leaned back in his chair and took a deep breath. He picked up his phone and called his aide. "Cancel all my appointments for the rest of the afternoon," he said. Then he turned to me, his face grim and his voice icily stern. "I will give you the rest of the day to justify that remark, Colonel Hackworth." Johnson walked briskly over to a large work table across from his desk and pulled out some Vietnam battle maps. "Every general who has fought in Vietnam has briefed me at this desk and with these maps," he said. I'd gotten his attention, so I decided to go for broke. "Sir, maybe that's the nub of the problem. Maybe those generals do not know how different the war is either. In my experience over there, and I have to admit I was only with one brigade, but we were all over Vietnam and I talked to a lot of people. The only people who really know how to fight this thing are the Australians and the Viet Cong." General Johnson and I talked at the work table for about an hour and a half. We refought the first of the 101's battles at Thuy Hoa and Doc To, discussed enemy tricks and tactics, and how, until we'd learned, the brigade fell for the enemy's lures and got itself chewed up again and again. When I'd made my case, the general put his arm around me and walked me to the door of his office. "Son," he said, "I'm going to think about all you've told me. I'm sure you've made some valid points, but if you're right, I must say it is most discouraging. I only hope this tour with Slam proves you wrong. Johnson patted my back. I'll have a look at what's happening at Fort Benning, too, he said. Meanwhile, Colonel, good luck. I felt as though I'd won him. I really did, and it felt great. At the end of the day, I met General Marshall for a drink. I told him about my meeting with the chief of staff and how knocked out I was that Johnson would compare Vietnam to Bataan or island combat. Marshall said, I agree with Johnny. Infantry combat is infantry combat. I could have fallen off my chair. Does he really believe that? I wondered. But I had no time to ask him because just then we were joined at our table by one of Slam's old friends, General Moshe Dayan. When you traveled with Slam, I was beginning to discover, it was first class all the way. The former chief of staff of the Israeli army had recently returned from Vietnam, where he'd looked at damn near everything. He'd accompanied platoon and company-size U.S. units deep into the highlands jungles, something I never heard of any American general doing in Vietnam at any time throughout the U.S. involvement. He'd observed larger actions, too, and come away incredulous over the American style of war. He thought our companies too eager to rush to battle at any price. He was amazed at our use of firepower, citing one case where the Americans fired more than 20,000 rounds of artillery in a single action. Yes, Dayan admitted, the action did result in some 200 enemy dead, but at a price of more than all the artillery used during